This is an InsightView.eu podcast.
In August, InsightView conducted a podcast interview with former White House advisor Mark Medish, where we discussed the domestic consequences of Donald Trump's second presidential term. The conclusion of that podcast opened the door for a follow-up episode. In this new podcast, InsightView discusses with Mark Medish the consequences of Donald Trump's foreign policy, which in many respects treats traditional allies worse than those who were once regarded as America's enemies. We will examine what President Trump aims to achieve with a foreign policy that is moving in multiple directions. What will it mean for the United States, and what are the consequences in particular for Europe? Mark Medish is an American lawyer and policy consultant with extensive experience in government and international affairs. During the Clinton administration, he served at the White House as special assistant to the president and senior director on the National Security Council, as well as deputy assistant secretary for international affairs at the U.S. Treasury. Mark Medish, thank you once again for taking the time to join the final podcast in our conversation about President Trump's second term in the White House. In this podcast, we focus on the foreign policy dimension.
Hey, Carsten, it's great to be with you to continue the dialogue.
Let us start with setting the scene. I'll begin in another place than Washington, namely in Beijing. President Xi recently said the world faces a choice between peace or war. That was a flamboyant statement. From your perspective, is this an exaggeration or a fair description of today's geopolitical reality?
Well, I think it was a bit like a fortune cookie, a cliche with some truth in it. We have another saying, a famous Latin saying, if you wish peace, prepare for war. The flip side of which is if you wish for war, take peace for granted. The point is you have to work at peace. Because war is very much part of the human condition. Unfortunately, a lot of human history is about war, and we have to work at peace. That's why we still read Homer. If you read the Iliad, sing, O goddess of the wrath of Achilles. War is in the minds of people.
If she is right that the world is in the dangerous moment, who bears the responsibility for getting us here?
Well, I think it's an important question, and the responsibility is collective over a period of time. You could argue that decisions and choices that were made after the Cold War, after 9/11. By Russia, by China, all of us collectively have gotten us to a very dangerous place today. Very much like the run-up to World War I, where great historians have said we were sleepwalkers. We sleepwalked into World War I. There were a lot of conditions and factors that came into play. Now, I'm not suggesting that another world war is inevitable. In fact, we have to work for the opposite. The basic point then is not so much the responsibility for getting us here, but the responsibility for getting us out of trouble. That's collective too.
What do you see currently as the most urgent risks in today's geopolitical environment?
Well, I would say, somehow we have to cure ourselves of long COVID. The whole world seems to be suffering from mistrust, paranoia, miscalculation, and the risk of confrontation. And so, we clearly are in a kind of Cold War number two, and we have a collective interest in avoiding World War number three. So that's the big risk, is that the current Cold War, which has flashpoints and hotspots, turns into a broader conflict. But there are other risks as well. There are risks of a new pandemic. The world just lived through a mass pandemic. Another one could come, and we need to be prepared for that. We also need to be prepared for You know, the impact of trade wars, if that ends up leading to a global economic recession, that will have political, social implications. And it can all tie together in creating an environment of more paranoia, feeling more threat, and more resort to military action. That's what we need to avoid.
Okay, then let us take a closer look at Donald Trump's return and the impact on U.S. foreign policy. Trump's return to power has created geopolitical vacuums that caught many countries, including the EU, off guard. Has his aggressive foreign policy surprised you, even though he largely telegraphed it during his campaign?
Well, I like your metaphor of vacuums, but I think there are also tornadoes. So it's a combination of vacuums and tornadoes. I would say that the aggressiveness of the foreign policy has not surprised me because it was telegraphed. I guess it's the radicalism of the agenda. It's a revisionist agenda. What has surprised me is that the there's a kind of lack of discipline, impulsiveness, and erratic content that keeps everybody guessing. There seem to be a lot of contradictions. So the lack of a clear strategic perspective does surprise me and worry me. But you're right that the radicalism of the agenda was telegraphed in advance. Trump wanted to change the approach quite substantially.
Do you see Trump's foreign policy as a form of American revisionism, a reaction against decades of globalization, and of course, allies' blatant exploitation of American resources at the expense of U.S. households?
Yes, I think clearly that's the thesis that has been laid out by Trump and many of his key advisors, also J.D. Vance, the vice president, among others. This sense that the U.S. was taken advantage of for decades. The U.S. was seen as a global utility, an insurance policy, sometimes a global policeman, but basically that somehow the U.S. was bearing an undue and unfair burden in protecting other countries. And that's been the foreign policy thesis, but it also has a domestic political aspect that was sold as a criticism of the previous administrations and an attempt to gain votes, saying that the previous administrations were focusing too much on America's global obligations and not enough on taking care of the homeland and America's own prosperity.
But the decision, for instance, to outsource, that was an American decision, and that benefited macroeconomically the U.S. economy.
Yes, no question about that. I mean, that was the globalization thesis, that there would be this win-win frontier of open borders, open capital flows, open trade, and so forth, and that this would lead to a net positive for the world. The problem, as we've learned, is that the distributive aspects of that were more complicated, and that there were, you know, winners and losers in the process. And the losers economically were located in certain places and in certain sectors and in certain countries. And so it's the domestic politics of globalization that I would say was really taken for granted and mishandled in the U.S. and maybe the West more broadly. And Trump saw an opportunity to take advantage of that. It's a populist argument, but it's not one without a material basis. In other words, if people feel that they're being left behind, political leaders need to deal with that and not just ignore it and tell them that everything will be later at some other point in time.
In particular, Europeans hold a very negative view of Donald Trump. That said, the fact remains that already during his first term in office, Donald Trump pointed out issues regarding dependence on China that the West should have focused on earlier. Did Trump in his first term have a point about something that we, the West, should have reacted to long ago?
Yes, I think that's a really fair and important point, that one needs to separate dislike, disapproval of Trump's answers and his style and his methods from necessarily rejecting the questions he's been asking and his supporters have been asking. And so, you know, you give one good example that, you know, perhaps he's making a good point about overdependence and taking for granted that the global supply room and the global department store and the global factory of the world economy would always be open. And shouldn't we be doing something to make sure that we don't unilaterally give up our own capacities against our own interests? So, you know, I think clearly there's a point in that wake-up call. And by the way, quite independent of Trump, again, the pandemic was a wake-up call that, you know, you don't want a situation where you lack the medical equipment, the supplies, the medicines, the antibiotics, the vaccines that you need in a crisis situation, because you're relying on the ability to import without limit from faraway places. I think there's a fair point that he's making there, and giving credit to some of Trump's questions without necessarily agreeing with all his answers is important.
The Trump administration talks a great deal about external threats, especially from China. On the other hand, the United States defense spending accounts for only about 3% or more of GDP, close to a historical low level. Furthermore, the defense industrial base has been shrinking in the last two decades. This does not indicate a country that has been particularly concerned. Is the United States' national security in far greater danger than many assess today?
You know, I think an argument can be made that the U.S. Did become a very consumer services-oriented society during the period of globalization, and this was bipartisan, and that we took our eye off the ball of military defense spending. You know, that said, the U.S. still clearly remains a technological leader in the military space. And many people would argue that, you know, some of our defense spending actually hasn't been of high quality. There's been a lot of waste. So it's not that we haven't always been spending enough. It's that we've been spending it on the wrong things. And you can get into debates about particular pieces of equipment, whether it's the F-35, is that as good an airplane as you want, aircraft carriers and so forth. Are these good investments or not? You know, the other thing to keep in mind, very, very important, is that there isn't this sharp distinction between civilian and military technological R&D, research and development. And you look at our strong Silicon Valley companies, and a lot of them are not focused only on, you know, social media and apps. They're focused on things with military uses. And so a lot of the big companies, SpaceX, Starlink, Palantir, Anduril, those are actually public-private partnerships with a lot of military defense implications and uses. And the U.S. has been quite strong on that front. If anything, it's Europe that has taken the situation for granted, I would argue. I think Europe has been, and I say this as a friend and half European, I think Europe has been in la-la land about defense and security for quite some time. And in terms of the investment opportunities, these public-private partnerships for multi-use, dual-use technologies. The Draghi report was on point a year ago, saying that Europe needs to collectively get unified around this agenda. If it doesn't, it will remain unprepared.
But part of the unofficial agreement between the United States and Europe has been that we bought a lot of U.S. military equipment. And if we, for instance, bought a F-35, we also bought a U.S. cloud solution, U.S. software. So you can say that the US also benefited from this arrangement between Europe and the United States.
I mean, absolutely. You could argue that actually NATO institutionalized a shopping market for US hardware, that there was actually underneath, you know, all the normative architecture and cooperation, political cooperation of NATO, it's really an arms bazaar that is based on U.S. supply and European consumption. And some of that, you know, may be also financed by the U.S., which is that's called vendor finance, but we're basically subsidizing the purchase of U.S. equipment. So it's good for the U.S. economy. That happens all the time. That's happened throughout the EU, where you've had vendor finance from stronger economies to weaker ones to buy products from the stronger economies. Ask Germany about its supplies of automobiles and consumer appliances and so forth to other countries within Europe using German credit. That's how the world works. That's how the world works.
The Trump administration believes that the US is militarily more vulnerable compared to 2 decades ago. If that's the case, then I do not understand why the Trump administration acts as it does. In an op-ed in the New York Times, Kurt Campbell, who served as Deputy Secretary of State, and Ross Doshi, who served as Deputy Senior Director for China and Taiwan Affairs on the National Security Council under President Joe Biden, warned the Trump administration against going it alone. The same warning came from James Mattis, who served as U.S. Defense Secretary from 2017 to 2018. They argue that the United States needs allies to be able to deal with China. Does the Trump administration prefer the U.S. to go it alone? And if so, why? And what is the underlying purpose of this approach?
Yeah, again, these are very big questions. I think the issue of investment in our defense industries and force structures is distinct from the question you're asking, which is, do we need alliances? And my answer is yes, we need alliances. Alliances enhance our security and our strength collectively. And so this is something we need to invest in, whether it's with Europe or Japan, Australia, other countries. Unfortunately, I think the paradigm that has emerged from the Trump administration is that we don't really have allies or enemies. We have risks and opportunities. We have clients and customers. And I think that's what people mean by the transactional approach, that allies are being reduced to clients. I think that's not in our interest. I think it's a very short-sighted approach. But it's tied to the overall protectionism and nationalism of the governing philosophy that we were talking about earlier. I mean, they were flagrant about this, that they believe that America on its own needs to be strong in the first instance, and then we'll talk about the rest. So this sense of solidarity is vastly diminished.
Mark, I have followed geopolitics with great interest for many years. However, I must admit that the Trump administration's inconsistent foreign policy has been mind-bending. During his first term in office, the president could, for instance, within the framework of the agreement with Denmark, have established several military bases in Greenland. He did not. Mark, with your insight into geopolitical affairs and deep knowledge of what is happening in Washington, can you explain what is it that Donald Trump wants, for example, with Greenland?
Well, Carson, you're certainly not alone in being confused by the inconsistency and erraticness, apparent contradictions of the Trump approach. Many of us are scratching our heads. It seems to me that if there is a kind of strategy here, it's to shake things up radically and basically set the stage for renegotiations of things that had been taken for granted for too long in the view of the Trump administration. You know, we also heard early on the idea of Canada as the 51st state, and then Greenland, the Greenland expedition started after that in terms of exploration and sort of threats. You know, the other takeaway is that the Trump view is that security is going to be based on spheres of influence, spheres of interest, and spheres of geographic security, and that North America is Trump's focus, and that includes Canada, and it stretches all the way into the rest of the Arctic over the Atlantic, and that includes Greenland. So it's a shaking up of existing assumptions, and I think we've seen that across the board. Whether that adds up to a genuine strategy or not, I'm very doubtful.
As a European, you must excuse me for asking the following questions. From my perspective, it feels like many allies and friends would like to cut their ties with Washington if it were not for their technological, economic, and military dependence on the United States. America's lack of credibility has become too significant from a European perspective. Do you see a danger that the United States is alienating its allies and friends?
Oh, absolutely. On the other hand, the constructive side of this, which I think a lot of European analysts and leaders have tried to seize on, is it's an opportunity for, it is a wake-up call. It's a correction of naive assumptions from the past and very simple over-reliance on the U.S. security blanket and U.S. protection. So yes, there is a big risk of driving allies away, but those allies should use this as an opportunity. I also think there is a lesson here, though, that Europeans naively may have assumed that participating in U.S. wars in the past would somehow give them unlimited credit in the future. And I'm thinking of, you know, Afghanistan, the Iraq War, and other interventions in the Middle East where European countries jumped in, including Denmark. And those were, in large part, wars of choice, not wars of necessity. They were not in accord with international law or norms, and European allies jumped in, supported. And now they're surprised to learn that within the U.S. itself, a movement developed criticizing those wars. I mean, again, Trump ran on the failures of the Bush and Cheney administration after 9/11. He denounced those interventions. And so anyone paying attention shouldn't have been that surprised that there would be consequences from Trump's return to political power.
In the same context, do you see the Shanghai Cooperation Organization summit a few weeks ago as an example of the diplomatic damage done by the Trump administration? Many experts argue that Beijing, Moscow, and North Korea effectively outmaneuvered Washington, leaving the U.S. increasingly home alone.
Well, it certainly was visually an impressive spectacle, both the gathering of the leaders and the military parade. At some level, Trump must have been thinking about the rather modest parade that he had in Washington a few months ago. By contrast, so it clearly the meeting in Tianjin sent a signal. I mean, I guess what I'm more worried about is that part of Trump wishes he could have been together with them. it's sort of whose side is he on? Because look at India. The case of India, we had spent a lot of effort over decades, really. Trying to get closer to India and build a partnership, strategic partnership with India, with great success. And Trump himself had participated in that. I mean, it started under Bill Clinton, continued under Bush, Cheney, Obama, Biden, Trump 1, Trump 2. And now suddenly India is there at the Shanghai Cooperation Organization Summit. So that looks like an own goal.
A huge one.
Huge. Again, you know, that's where the tactic of shaking things up, which may have some merit in the abstract, actually is without any strategic purpose, and contradicts our interests and objectives. So again, even if Trump has asked some of the right questions, the answers are far from persuasive. And in fact, they're causing a lot of concern on many fronts, from the trade wars to other security matters.
You just opened the door for another question. In 1939, the Soviet Union entered into a non-aggression pact with Nazi Germany, which cost Poland its existence. The fear of a similar agreement between Moscow and Washington is clearly present in Europe. Whether or not this fear is exaggerated, there is no doubt that the Trump administration speaks with two tongues when it comes to Russia. Can you explain to me what drives Donald Trump to treat President Putin with kid gloves? Hopefully, it's not because he believes he can separate Russia and China from each other.
Well, this is a huge, we're opening a whole chapter of questions about what motivates Trump on Russia. You know, there are those who think that he's some kind of an asset. You know, we get into the debate over the Steele dossier and things like that. I'm not sure that's the direction you want to go in. It seems to me that Trump somehow believes that he's in a position to improve relations with Russia, end the war in Ukraine with some kind of a ceasefire armistice arrangement, that this would be an element in his case for the Nobel Prize, that he's actually a peacemaker, he's a peace broker. And, you know, these hopes might be very misplaced. So far, he does not have results to show. So his expectation that his dialogue with Putin would help end the war in Ukraine, we still haven't seen the results, which is very disappointing. Whether he believes he can drive a wedge between Russia and China is another big question. I would argue that one misunderstanding of Trump is probably that he's actually, at the end of the day, less pro-Russia and less anti-China than people commonly believe, and that with China foremost, he wants an economic deal. That would be the big win. And we saw that in the first term. He placed a huge emphasis on renegotiating trade agreements with China, the phase one and phase two deals that were being negotiated and finalized right as COVID unleashed. So it could be that he actually has rather pragmatic ambitions with China, and he sees that China as far more important strategically than Russia, and that this could be an area where Europe and the U.S. see things quite differently because of Russia's proximity. Europe sees Russia as a much more exigent, nearby threat than the U.S. does.
In the same context, Mark, maybe you can elaborate a little bit on Trump's proposal for the European Union that if they impose 100% import tariffs on Indian and Chinese goods, the U.S. will do the same.
I fear you're asking me to try to make sense of what doesn't make sense. So I really have no explanation. I think, again, it looks like an almost desperate use of a tactic to shake things up. In the hope that will lead to some better negotiating position down the line. That's the best I can say about that.
Because it's totally impossible for the European to agree about such a proposal.
Exactly. It's completely unrealistic. So, I mean, that's the paradox and danger here, that a foreign policy philosophy and approach that claims to be realistic is actually based on fantasies and fundamental contradictions.
Let us close the U.S. foreign policy under the leadership of Donald Trump with the last question. What is U.S. foreign policy? Isolationism, imperialism, or simply bullying weaker countries as much as possible to make them pay to Uncle Sam? That was a provocative European question.
It's a good provocative question. And I think it's important to put it in the context of where we're coming from. I mean, there was always, you know, U.S. policy has not been monolithic. There's always been a debate. There's been a debate between, you might say, idealism and realism. And the idealists also took the form of the neoconservatives. But this idea that the world was making progress toward common values and global governance and a rules-based system, et cetera, on one side, versus realists and maybe pragmatists who didn't disagree about the values or the desirability of such a world, but disagreed fundamentally about the probability of achieving it. Because of the difficulty of the project. And so they counseled caution and prudence. Okay. That historically has been the debate in the U.S. I would say that the U.S., in that period of debate, Cold War, post-Cold War, has enjoyed a kind of informal empire. You know, we were not an empire like the 19th, 18th century European empires, conquering foreign lands and so forth, but we definitely had a global projection of interests and influence and presence using all kinds of different methods. That's our informal empire, and that has led to our prosperity. And it has also led to, I would argue, overextensions and interventions that turned out not to be in our interest, like the wars in the Middle East we were discussing earlier. Trump's response has been a criticism of that, of all of it. Saying, no, there's another approach that's based much more rigorously on narrow U.S. security interests that will make us great again, in quotes. And there's a mix of different views within his movement between isolationism and very targeted interventionism. So yes, there are isolationist elements in terms of not relying on alliances. But at the same time, we saw projection of force with the B-2s, the bombing of Iran, of the nuclear facilities. We just saw, you know, a kind of military police action against a Venezuelan drug trafficking vessel with threats of more of the same. The U.S. claims it wasn't involved in the strike in Doha, but that's to be seen. How much we knew, when we knew it, how much we supported it. Yes, isolationism, but that doesn't mean no military muscle. And yes, bullying weaker countries. Unfortunately, we seem to be entering the old world. You know, I quoted Homer before, but you could also go to Thucydides and the history of the Peloponnesian War, where the lesson was that the strong do what they can and the weak do what they must, more like the law of the jungle. And the shock is that that view now seems to be coming to the fore in Washington, which had previously been much more focused on building global architecture, building it on U.S. terms to the U.S. advantage, but building global cooperation. And that seems to be far less interesting to the current administration.
But at least in the past, it was an institutionalized system.
Yes, it was an institutionalized system, but it was very American-driven and American-focused. And I think we lose sight of that because I think a lot of other countries said, well, yes, you're building a system, you're building institutions, but you're building it from a position of advantage. And you're using Western and American standards to define those institutions. And you're calling that globalization. And I think that's a view that we see from coming out of a lot of other powers, including the ones you've mentioned, Beijing, Moscow, India, who viewed the previous period of globalization as not fully multilateral, not fully multipolar, but more as Americanization and Westernization by a different name. That's really what the power struggle is about.
Let us talk about China, which appears to be the Trump administration's primary opponent. Looking ahead 10 to 20 years, what do you think Xi Jinping ultimately wants for China? Regional dominance, global leadership, or simply getting the United States out of the East and South China Sea?
Yeah, there's little question that the Chinese and also the Russians, I mean, this was the subject of the so-called No Limits Summit and partnership from a few years ago that continues, that they see the U.S. and the West as declining powers in the overall global scheme. And they want to try to consolidate their positions, they call multipolarity, consolidate their positions and advantages. And of course, China and Russia are vastly different, but they shared that one point of analysis, which is this was the moment to test the West and the U.S. in particular. So I think that is part of the agenda. I think students of China would agree that the main focus of the leaders of China really has been internal prosperity. You know, they have vast populations and rising expectations, actually an aging vast population, and they have to manage that. So prosperity, internal prosperity is the name of the game. There's a limit to how much pushing an international agenda is really acceptable and successful in the Chinese context. But so I think that you asked what is Xi Jinping after? I think he's after prosperity, but also a form of parity, prosperity and parity with the West. Doesn't want to be pushed around. You know, and it goes back to, you know, the 19th century history of the unequal, so-called unequal treaties, when the British Empire came in, the Opium Wars, and tried to establish terms of trade with China, which successive Chinese regimes, first imperial and then republican and then communist, viewed as unfair and unequal. So there, in a sense, this history of China and trade and globalization started a long time ago. It didn't just start. And there is a long-term quest by the Chinese to stand up on a stronger footing and not to accept lecturing from the West. I think that's the agenda.
Has Trump's confrontational style toward allies ironically helped Beijing present itself as a more attractive global partner?
Yes, but it wasn't just Trump. I mean, I think the U.S., in a sense, has been retreating from a lot of places in the world in terms of investment and presence for quite a number of years now, even before Trump. I spent a lot of time in Africa and other places. And, you know, this is where the Chinese are showing up, and they're showing up with finance, and they're showing up with projects. They build things. So this contest, this rivalry has been playing out in many, many different places. Yes, I agree. Trump's open rift with North Atlantic allies has not helped us at all. It has weakened our position, for sure. It's an own goal. It's completely unnecessary. And that's vis-a-vis China, vis-a-vis Russia as well.
Mark, Beijing has not used its military to defend supply chains or allies even after U.S. and Israeli strikes on Iran. Does China possess the necessary self-confidence to protect its overseas interests through military means? And what would be the geopolitical significance if it were to happen?
Well, it probably depends where we're talking about. If we're talking about the Taiwan Straits or South China Sea, the answer might be different from farther flung places along the Belt and Road, where China also has interests.
But for instance, in the Middle East?
Well, throughout Central Asia, the Middle East, yes, into Africa, yes. That's the Chinese informal empire. In a sense, they're paying homage to the U.S. by developing their own geostrategic economic empire. That has been the Belt and Road project. with all its flaws. I mean, it hasn't been a total success by any means. It may be an overreach, but China does have this vast informal empire, largely geared at getting access to raw materials, commodities, resources, critical metals and the like, fuel supplies, and the exchanges that they build things. They build infrastructure. It may not be up to Western standards, but it is infrastructure. Bridges, tunnels, ports, railways, you name it. But more on China's philosophy, driving philosophy, I don't think it's new to the Communist Party. I mean, it goes back to Sun Tzu, the great theorist of strategy, you know, who said that it's smarter to try to subdue your enemy without fighting. So, you know, whether or not China has the confidence to engage in hot warfare is one question, but I think they've certainly shown the patience and drive to compete with us without fighting. And by the way, I think they're not displeased that Russia made the mistake of going into hot conflict with the West in Ukraine. Let the Russians do the dirty work and test the West directly in a military confrontation, while China cooperates with Russia and continues on its own strategic path. It's sort of a cynical win-win.
And one could also ask, how strong is China's military today, especially after Xi Jinping's extensive purchase in the armed forces?
Well, I think there's little doubt that China has been effectively modernizing. Is it an effective military? Does it have the morale, the discipline, the training, and so forth? That's always a different question. There are technological capacities that are quite impressive. Implementation is a different matter, and you know, it's to be seen. There were a lot of people who thought, when was it, 45 years ago, when China had a conflict with Vietnam, that China would easily win in 1979, but it did not. In fact, it was basically beaten back by the Vietnamese forces after incursions into the north of Vietnam. So they've clearly modernized since then, but how good a fighting force they actually are is an open question.
Let us end this podcast with Europe. Mark, assume you are now hired to advise Europe. How should Europe develop into an independent global actor after decades of being reliant on China for production, Russia for energy, and the US for defense?
Well, I'd use the American phrase, get cracking. Focus on your own house. Again, I go back to the Draghi report as just one example of the type of strategic commitment that Europe needs. But it's not just about defense. It has to be seen as an integrated investment strategy in technological modernization, in deepening of internal markets and competitiveness. The European project is such a smart project, but it's a work in progress. It's only half complete, unfortunately. And in recent times, the movement has not been encouraging. I mean, Brexit, I think, was really bad news for both the UK and for Europe. That partnership should be much stronger than it is. And so, ironically, at a time that everyone was worried about Grexit, that the Greeks, a relatively small economy, might leave Europe and the Eurozone, it was the British who voted to leave this project. So, you know, what is to be done? There's a political dimension here. Europe needs to join forces and unify further, or face the consequences of divisions, which is sort of the direction we're headed in right now. And think about American history. America faced the same kind of choice when we were 13 colonies, and we had a loose confederation of cooperation, but we had a very weak central government, and a very weak sharing of fiscal and debt instruments. And that all had to be corrected. That's the origin of the U.S. Constitution. Well, Europe is still a work in progress on that front.
You can say that the last 150 years, all immigrants coming to the U.S., they knew the Constitution. In Europe, we're trying to find a common constitution together. That's a complicated task.
Well, I mean, Europe has still had a huge power of attraction. There are a lot of immigrants who wanted to come to Europe. It's just that Europe has lost confidence in its ability to deal with those flows. There may have been some naive assumptions about how Europe's capacity to integrate them. So, you know, yes, there have been migration stories. Yes, a source of U.S. strength is that it wins by attraction. People want to come to the U.S. because it's the land of opportunity. But Europe can be the same thing if it gets its house in order.
With a weak and unpredictable political center in France and Germany, who could realistically step up as a unifying force in Europe? And will it still be within the European Union?
Well, I think, you know, right now the big unifying force is probably Donald Trump. He's the one sending the signal that you guys better get your act together. So, you know, maybe he deserves a Nobel Peace Prize for that. Ironically, let me give credit to another Italian leader, former Prime Minister Enrico Letta, who also wrote a report on the European internal market and human capital and education, because that's another part of the story. You see, it's not just an issue of migration from outside of Europe into Europe that poses an opportunity and a challenge. It's also migration within Europe, where people are leaving poorer countries to go to wealthier ones. So the imbalances grow. How do you reverse that? All of this has to be addressed. And I'm an optimist. I believe in human reason and rationality. And I believe in all the Western values that came out of the Renaissance and Enlightenment. We need to put those to work.
Do Europe need a strong leader without a mustache?
I know what you mean. You definitely need it without that type of mustache. Stronger leadership or stronger solidarity. But it shouldn't just be happening with seven people sitting in the hallway outside of the Oval Office. It needs to be happening internally in Europe organically. I think we're seeing some signs of it, but it feels a bit too little, a bit too late. That's my fear.
My final two questions. Looking forward, given a weak EU, a divided US, a rising China, and a disruptive Russia, how do you see the global situation evolving in the coming years?
I think we're seeing a global rebalancing, which could end up more unstable or more stable. That's what's up for grabs. I don't think a return to the status quo ante is realistic. And I think that's part of the wake-up call. Things are really changing. It doesn't mean that war, you know, World War III is inevitable, but we are going to need to rededicate ourselves to not making naive and rich assumptions, but really doing the hard work of multilateralism and diplomacy to try to avoid disaster and build up new institutions and rules to mitigate risk. And, one area I don't know if I mentioned sufficiently before is arms control, that we need to relearn that whole lesson from the nuclear era when, you know, there was an arms race that could have led to Armageddon. And there was a wake-up after the 1950s, the Sputnik moment, Cuban Missile Crisis. John F. Kennedy gives a famous speech that opens the doorway to detente and a negotiation on arms control over weapons of mass destruction, nuclear ones at that time. And it led to a series of treaties with the Soviet Union, even at a time that we were engaged in a hot conflict in Vietnam during the height of the Cold War. So that did not prevent us from addressing our strategic interests in multilateral diplomacy with people we didn't agree with. Kennedy said in his famous speech, "We have profound differences with the Soviet Union, but we have a shared interest in preserving a world in which we can have those differences." That's a starting point. And today, it's not just nuclear technologies. It's also space weapons, satellites, rockets. It's also biotech. And it's also AI cyber, which cuts across all the other technologies and, in a sense, turbocharges them. Now more than ever, we need to do arms control on a global scale. And that's going to take leaders who aren't scared to talk with each other on the basis of shared interests, mutual interests, hard-headed interests.
To contradict this a little, do small and medium-sized countries not have every reason to acquire nuclear weapons themselves in the future?
Well, I mean, I think that is part of the darker scenario, actually. That would mean that we're going down the path of less stability in the long run. When you say acquire nuclear weapons, it's not as easy as it sounds, you know, to actually have fully functional delivery systems for nuclear weapons. Yes, you're right. There's a certain logic saying, okay, if our previous security arrangements have fallen apart, we need to go nuclear ourselves. I think we have a shared interest in avoiding that outcome. And again, that's what happened during the first Cold War. There was a risk of going down that direction. And that's why we started engaging in nuclear nonproliferation negotiations, treaties, monitoring, surveillance, and so forth. It wasn't perfect. There are new nuclear powers, India, Pakistan, North Korea. All of that has to be taken into account. I would argue we want to keep that under control. And again, it requires diplomacy and engagement to do so. I would add, there is this myth about Ukraine and the Budapest Memorandum and giving up nuclear weapons. Ukraine never had control of the nuclear weapons that were housed on Ukrainian territory. The command and control was not in Kiev. And so that actually is a false lesson that Ukraine somehow shouldn't have given up nuclear weapons. Okay, same with Kazakhstan. Kazakhstan housed nuclear capacities but did not control them. So, and that was for a reason. You know, reason we want to try to contain the spread of these technologies and weapons of mass destruction. There's a shared interest in that. Let me add, because Tom Friedman had a very interesting piece in the New York Times recently, not on the nuclear, but on artificial intelligence and cyber, arguing that actually the U.S. and China need to cooperate in this sphere. And really, it's built on the analogy with nuclear arms control. But he's basically saying the reality of this technology, cyber, will be mutual assured destruction. And we need to accept that and therefore engage in systematic risk reduction, that we provoke each other into an arms race that cannot be won, or into a war that cannot be won. That's the heart of arms control. That's what the movie Oppenheimer was all about, which grossed over $1 billion. It's amazing that a movie about nuclear history could have competed with Barbie. But that movie contained important lessons for humanity that we ought to take seriously.
But that also require that superpowers provide security guarantees and not threats against medium and smaller sized countries.
100%. We have to get back in that direction. I totally agree with you. Totally agree.
Mark Metis, once again, thank you for sharing your insightful experience in Washington and international diplomacy with InsideView.eu.
Thank you, Carsten. A pleasure.